will be taking over the course. So today we end our treatment of quantum phase transitions by showing a new approach to quantum phase transition based on quantum information theory. So therefore, today's topic is quantum information approach to QPTs. So most, basically, everything I will say, you can find most of it in this recent paper, PRL 99-106-03-2007 by Paolo Zanardi et al. Okay, so we've seen that basically quantum phase transitions are so far marked by the behavior of the correlation functions in the ground state for some specific value of the parameters of the Hamiltonian. And this is a very hands-on phenomenological approach because correlation functions are ultimately what we can measure. But now we want to ask a different type of questions. So what is really happening to the ground state wave function as we change our parameters lambda in the Hamiltonian? Okay, so we have our Hamiltonian depends on a set of parameters lambda and depends on them in a smooth way. The set of parameters can be just a manifold, so a point lambda as some coordinates, lambda 1, lambda n. So for instance, in the Ising model, we have only one coordinate that was basically g. In the XY model, we saw that we had two, that was the anisotropy and the external magnetic field. So for every value of lambda, we can diagonalize the Hamiltonian and find the ground state. And then at some point, there is some critical point, and something happens to this ground state. Okay? And we saw that in the case of continuous phase transitions, it means that the first derivative of the ground state is not analytic. So, but we would like to understand precisely what this means. What does it mean for the first derivative of a quantum mechanical wave function to be non-analytic. So now we go back to the fundamental interpretation of quantum mechanics in which wave functions must mean something. And in fact, they must mean a probability distribution. The wave function is a way for us to extract a probability distribution that tells us the result of all the possible measurements that we can do on that system. And it's a probabilistic theory, therefore there is a probability distribution. So what we would like to see is this. What happens when I am deep in the phase, okay, before the phase transition occurs? So I have some ground state, and then I slightly change this parameter lambda, and I obtain the new ground state for a slightly different value of the parameter lambda. So we know that if we're deep in the phase and the physics is basically the same, nothing dramatic should happen. So in some sense, these two states should be very similar, right? I should be able to differentiate. Of course, there are some complicances because we have seen that as soon as I move a little bit in the parameter space, in the thermodynamic limit, these two states could be orthogonal. So in some sense, they're also very different. So we must be able to say in what sense they are very similar, although they seem to orthogonalize very quickly. So what we need is a good notion of distance. On the manifold of the on L, that is the manifold of ground states. Okay? So the manifold of ground states is obtained in this way by this mapping. I pick a lambda. This means I have some Hamiltonian. And then I diagonalize the Hamiltonian from the ground state. So I will have a family of ground states parameterized by these lambdas. Okay? And we want to find a distance on this set. Of course, I could define a family of states depending on lambda in other ways that may not have interesting physical content, but this has a physical content. This is the ground state corresponding to the set of parameters lambda that we've chosen for our Hamiltonian. Okay. So we want to find, first of all, a distance between states in the Hilbert space. And we want to find a distance that has both the correct mathematical properties that we will show. So you can see that I am heading towards trying to put a metric tensor on this manifold of parameters. So somehow I want to show that there is a differential geometry associated to the Hilbert space. And this is able to capture the quantum phase transition. So mathematically, we want to find the notional distance that will allow us to define a good metric tensor, exactly like those that you use in general relativity, only on a space that is slightly more complicated because this is the Hilbert space. So it's a projective space of this. It's the space of rays, actually, because they are normalized states. So we need the correct mathematical properties. But most of all, it must mean something, because we really want to understand what happens to the wave function in its probabilistic interpretation. OK, so to this end, we first have to understand what is a good distance between probability distribution. So imagine that, so let's start with a very simple example. Imagine that we have a coin with the heads and tails. So we have a probability distribution with only two outcomes that are heads and tails. But it's a weighed coin, right? Okay, so it's not a fair coin. It has a probability P, let me say P1, of yielding heads. So how do, if you're given such a coin, and of course the other one is 1 minus P1. So this is my probability distribution. But imagine that I give you the coin. So how do you measure this P1? What do you do? Well, you can do only one thing. You can throw it a certain number of times and recording the number of heads, right? So number of heads, and this is the number of trials. And the frequentistic definition of probability is that you obtain the real one when n goes to infinity, which we cannot do, right? So imagine that you are given two coins and you, throw them a very large n, but not infinite. And you get, for one coin, you got get P1. So you get one probability distribution for the first coin, and then you get P2 for the second coin. So how do I know if P1 is really different from P2? Just because I get a different number? Right? So there is some uncertainty, right? So what is the uncertainty? What is the standard deviation of this? Well, this is something you know very well, but I remind you, is P1, 1 minus P1 over square root of n. So when n is, so this standard deviation shrinks like 1 over square root of n. So in the large n limit, this is very peaked. And therefore, we might, if they are peaked enough, then we can distinguish these two. So when is that we can distinguish them? When the difference of these two values is greater than the sum of the two variances. Right? So now imagine that I want to talk about, I have two probability distributions, P1 and another one, PF, final probability distribution. And I want to introduce a notion of distance, okay? So given a certain number of trials N, I can define P2, that is the first probability distribution that I can distinguish from P1 given this condition. And then I can construct P3, that is the first one that I can distinguish from this one, and so on. Okay? So I have a certain number of intermediate mutually distinguishable. So number of intermediate mutually distinguishable probability distributions, which I can use as a definition of the distance between P1 and PF. So unfortunately, this number depends on square root of n, because as n grows, this number will increase, and it will increase like square root of n, right? So a good definition of distance between P1 and PF will be given by the large n limit, so large n, of this number of intermediate EM dp. Let me call it this way. But let me normalize it with 1 over square root of n, because I want something that does not depend on n. Okay. So, and if so, I can write this in this way. If I have several, in the large n limit, I have many of these, so I can count by integrating. So I can integrate between P1 and PF. And so what is the number is dp over the length of this interval, that is therefore 2 square root of p minus p times 1 minus p. And then, of course, there is square root of n. But then I put this, and they cancel. Right? Because the inverse of this this interval is given by twice this, right? When p1 and p2 are close, that is 2p. So this is a good definition of distance between probability distributions. Okay. And this is called, in information theory, Fisher-Rao distance. All right. Okay, so this is for classical probability distributions. So the only way, let me also, okay, so let me also say, so if you integrate, so let me write it here again. So you can perform this integration, and what you find is that this is approximately arccos of p1 1/2 pf 1/2 plus 1 minus p1 1/2 1 minus pf 1/2. Okay, so this is just the result, approximate result of this integration. So this is for a probability distribution that has only two outcomes, that is a coin, but a general discrete probability distribution will have, so now let me put the index one here to say label which probability distribution I'm talking about. And I here is labeling the different outcomes. So instead of having I being just heads and tails, now I have many facets of a dice. So this is basically a generalized weighted die. So in which the face, it's not a fair die. Okay, it's not the flat distribution. So in general, you can guess that when you have more outcomes, the distance between p1 and p2 is given by the arccos of the sum of pi 1, pi 2, 1/2, 1/2. It's just the direct generalization of this. Okay. So when you have a probability distribution like this, a classical probability distribution, all you can do to measure it is to throw a die. Right? There's nothing else that you can do. You can just test it like this. Now let's go to quantum mechanics. Okay. Now instead of having a classical probability distribution, we have quantum states. So now instead of p1 and p2, we have psi1 and psi2. So they give a probability distribution, but they are not a classical probability distribution. We like to say that they are a quantum probability distribution. So what do these words mean? In what is different quantum mechanics from classical probability theory? What is really different from the point of view of probability distributions that distinguishes them? Yep. Okay, so interference, that's very good. But let's try to talk just from the point of view of probability. Okay, so this thing is related to interference, of course. But let's just talk. So interference is not stated directly in terms of probability. So what is really different is that you can measure in different bases. And different measurements do not commute, right? So you get different answers if you measure a spin along Z than along X. Okay, so in a classical probability theory, you can sample as you want, right? You don't have bases that exclude each other. So choosing a basis in which we are measuring our psi means choosing a measurement apparatus, which basically means to choose an observable A. So why an observable A fixes a basis? Because it's an admission operator. And therefore, can be diagonalized in a basis that is a basis for the whole Hilbert space, right? So this, it has a spectral resolution. So these are, in other words, these phi i's are the eigenvectors of my observable A. So now I can decide to measure this operator, right? And the probability of obtaining the I outcome, which is AI, when I have my initial preparation, my physical system psi one, is given by, so the prob of this. So it's just the Born rule. It's just phi I psi one. That right? It's just the Born rule. So this is quantum mechanics 101. So this is the probability given the way I'm deciding to measure my system. And if I prepare my system in psi two, similarly, I will have this probability. So let me call this P1, some probability distribution depending on I, right? The probability of the ith outcome is P1i, this one. And similarly, with psi two, I have P2. Okay, so now this is a good probability distribution, and therefore I can say, oh, my distance between psi one and psi two, if I measure the statistical distance with the observable A, well, it's given by what? By the what I wrote before. So you agree? So this is the statistical distance given this way of measuring. Okay, but we want something absolute, right? We want to know the real statistical distance between the two initial preparations, psi one and psi two. So all I need to do is to find the most discriminating measurement. So, for instance, I could find that this psi one and psi two, when I measure A, are quite close, but maybe because it's because I'm not using measuring in the right way, right? I am only measuring something which they are very similar. So the real distance is the maximum of all these measurements, over all the measurements that I can do. Okay? So the distance between psi one and psi two is the max over all the possible observables of the A. Okay, psi one, psi two. So usually maximizations over a Hilbert space are a very daunting task, but in this case, it's easy. It's very easy. You can easily see that the maximum of this is attained when I choose an observable such that one of its eigenvectors is x at psi 1. Say phi 1, for instance, I could pick my A being A1, psi 1, psi 1, plus other terms that are orthogonal. This means just what I was writing here, right? This is a spectral resolution. I'm saying I pick as an observable to measure whether the state is psi 1 or not, and other things. Well, so if you pick this, you definitely maximize. It's not the unique way of maximizing it, but it works. Well, and then what you find is arc cos of, okay, so here you have the identity, but this is forced to be psi 1. Ah, so we found something. That the statistical distance that is measured in a completely operational way. So we are measuring the distance by picking what is the most discriminating measurement that I can do in order to distinguish two quantum states is given by the angle between two states. Two rays, actually, right? Because the normalization, the length doesn't count. Only the direction counts. By the way, if psi 1 and psi 2 are close enough, which is the case in which we are interested because somehow we want to do differential geometry, then this is obviously 2, 1 minus this overlap. That is called fidelity, calligraphic F. And this distance on states in the Hilbert space is called Fubini study distance. Okay. So this is the meaning of distance of states in the Hilbert space. Any states in the Hilbert space. But now we want to put inside the fact that our states are not any states in the Hilbert space, but they are a family of states psi 0 lambda that are obtained by getting the ground state of H lambda. Okay? So first of all, we will show how the fact that they depend on this parameter lambda in a way that is continuous, because we are admitting non-analyticity only from the second order on, only in the, from the derivatives on. So we are explicitly, when we deal with quantum phase transitions, we are eliminating the possibility of level crossings, as we did before. So the only way a gap can shrink to zero is in the thermodynamic limit. So for the finite system, there are never level crossings. So psi of lambda is continuous. And then it's maybe something happens to the derivatives. OK. So let's see. So what do we do? Okay, so before I go ahead, so I want to understand what happens when I apply my distance between two states that are close by. So this one and phi psi 0 of lambda plus delta lambda. Okay, so we just said that when they're close, this is equal to 2, 1 minus the fidelity. So a question you might ask is the following. Why you didn't choose as a measure of distance in the Hilbert space just this? So this seems to be a distance. Why did we have to go through this? So there are two reasons. So one is the operational one. So this might be just good mathematically, but I wanted to show you a measure of distance that has an operational content in terms of statistical distance. The second reason is that because physically I have this U1 invariance, right? I instead of psi 1, I can put a face here. And also in psi 2. So when from this distance, I obtain a metric tensor in a way that I'll show you in a moment, we will not see it. So believe me, this will not be U1 invariant. So it's not the geometric tensor that we get. The metric tensor that we get doesn't have any physical meaning because it varies. We change the phase. So in order to have it work, I have to put the phase here. And I have to gauge them away by taking, for instance, the inf of alpha 1 and alpha 2. Okay, so now this looks better. Now this will not depend on the phases. And if you do the calculations, what you find is the Fubini study metric. So it's unique. The one that is operationally meaningful is the only one that is unitarily invariant in the Hilbert space. So it's the one that we need. Okay. So what I want to do now is to show how to derive a metric tensor. So first of all, let me define some quantities that I will use so that they're more compact. So I will call gamma ij the real part of the scalar product between the derivative of psi and the derivative along I and along j. Okay? And then I will call beta I like minus I this other term. So these are just definitions. Okay. So now let's see. I need another blackboard for this. Let's see what happens. So I want to reconstruct my quantity Fubini study metric. That, as you can see, is expressed in terms of the fidelity, that is an overlap. So I want explicitly to compute the overlap between two nearby states. So I want two states. One is psi s, and the other one will be psi s plus ds. And I want the overlap between these two. OK, so I will just expand this. So S is what I was calling lambda, but let me use S. Okay. So what is this? This is psi S plus di of psi S, yes, I. And I'm using the Einstein convention, so I'm summing over the repeated indices. Plus 1 over half di dj psi s dsi dsj plus. Okay. And now I want to take the overlap, so the scalar product between these. So before I was writing like this, right? So allow me to go between the cat notation and parenthesis notation, because I okay. So what is this? This will be 1 plus the scalar product between this and this, which is bi. And then there is the S, right? Yes. And plus 1 half. And we have psi I. No, we have psi, di, dj, psi, dsi, ds. Plus other terms. And the fidelity is the modulus of this. So the modulus of this contains the real part of this object. So we have 1 plus 1 half the real part of this. One half is everywhere. And this one is real already. So this will be just beta I, beta j. And then there is dsi, dsj. So this is just the modulus of this, which is the fidelity. OK, then now there are a few tricks. So if you differentiate twice the normalization, you will see that this object is equal to minus the real part of di psi dj psi, which is minus gamma ij. So plugging everything into the Fubini study metric, that is, this is f, yeah. So what we get is gamma ij minus beta I s beta j s dsi dsj. OK, we are done, because now this tensor defines my gij of s. So the Fubini study metric, we can also call it the square of the line element, that is the differential distance on our manifold. Ah, OK. So now we know what is a quantum geometric tensor. It's this object. So it's obtained by taking scalar products of the derivatives of the state. So now let's apply this. Now let's plug in the information that this psi here is not any psi, any continuous family of psi in S, but now psi is my psi zero of lambda. So it's the ground state of something. So because the important ingredient is this one, is the derivative with respect to a parameter. So let me write it like this. So differential geometers like to do this, right? To use this notation. OK, so I want to understand what is this, knowing that psi zero is the ground state of a Hamiltonian. Do you have any suggestion what we could do to try to see what it is. So I have to somehow to bring in the Hamiltonian. And I'm taking the derivative of this thing. Any idea? So let's see. So this is the derivative with when I change a little bit with the mu, right? So let's see, maybe what I understand it if I want to compute this. I change my lambda a little bit. For instance, in the mu direction. But now in some direction, okay? So how can I express this state and use the Hamiltonian? I can do perturbation theory, right? I can say that this is the state before the variation plus a perturbation. What is this perturbation? I have to sum over all the states that are not the ground state, right? Because I'm perturbing the ground state. Then I have the gap. Right? Then what I have? I have n, the n eigenstate, the excited states. Then I have n. And here I have the how my Hamiltonian changes when I go from lambda pi delta lambda, which is my perturbation, psi zero of lambda. So this is approximate, right? Because it's perturbation theory. Do you agree with this expression? Okay, now you see that what is this? This is just this minus this over delta lambda in the limit that delta lambda goes to zero. In that limit, the other terms go to zero automatically. So on the tangent space, perturbation theory is exact, in other words. So this one is exactly this object here. It's not approximate. And now, what is this? When I differentiate in this way, it's just the derivative of H. So this is the important ingredient. This is the ingredient we need. Okay? Because our metric tensor is defined only in terms of these quantities and scalar product of those. So if you plug them all together with the right indices, you obtain that G mu nu is the real part of this. And this is not a difficult exercise to do, but I advise you to do it. Okay. At some point, you have to insert the resolution of identity. This is the only not completely straightforward thing to do in order to get to this expression. Okay, so great. We have our metric tensor in terms of the Hamiltonian and the spectrum of our system. And this gives us the distance between nearby states in the ground state manifold. Okay. So we can see that when the gap goes to zero, something might diverge here. So we start seeing already at this level that maybe something in this metric tensor blows up when the gap is closing at the quantum critical point. But we cannot conclude this yet because, you know, we have the sum of so many terms and there could be cancellations. So we have to be a bit more careful. We cannot conclude. We just see a hint here. Okay, so what we do is the following. We apply this to some specific model. Okay. So application. To the quantum XY model. So I remind you the Hamiltonian is minus some. So you let me use this notation. So I have L spins equal to 2m plus 1. So I have I running from minus m to plus m. And this Hamiltonian can be diagonalized, as we said, by Jordan-Wigner transformation, followed by Fourier transform, followed by Bogoliubov. And the result of this diagonalization is the following, is that HXY lands into sum over k of some operators b, and then there is an offset, and so let me, oh, and of course here there are these energies lambda k, and lambda k are precisely this, so epsilon square k plus gamma square sine square. So here, I write explicitly this formula without having taken the continuous limit, like in the previous lecture where k started as an integer, then it became a continuous variable. So now I am keeping it like an integer, but you can see that as this is L. L becomes large, this becomes a continuous variable. And this epsilon k is this number minus gamma. No, minus h. Okay. Now let me define this angle. This is a definition that I will use in a moment. So basically, these are the angles of the Bogoliubov transformation that I want to rewrite because I want to use it. So Bogoliubov transformations was giving us our new operators by starting with the initial fermions. That I called C in the previous lecture, CK. minus I sine theta over 2. Okay. So the reason why I'm doing this is that for our purposes, that we want to compute this object. To compute this object, we need to compute the overlaps between the ground states. Since we can diagonalize the system, we don't need to go through the Hamiltonian. We can directly compute this gamma ij, right? Because we have the expression of the ground state. So we need these overlaps. A convenient way of computing them is to write the ground state in terms of these operators. So we know that the ground state is the vacuum of the destruction operators B. But now I will write it. So my ground state GS in terms of gamma and H, I will write it in terms of these operators. Well, and you can see that it's just the tensor product of terms like this that create a fermion with moment or destroy a fermion with momentum k or minus k. So this will be written in this way, the tensor product . So we either have this vacuum, or we have this excited state in terms of the C fermions. Oh, there is an I, yes. It's I. Okay. So this is a better expression because now because it's a tensor product, it's easy to compute the overlap between this and the state when we change slightly gamma and H. So let me call Q the pair gamma and H, and Q tilde another pair with different values. And I want to compute the overlap between the ground state at Q at the ground state at Q tilde. Okay, so you plug in this, you do all the tensor products, you do just a little algebra. What you find is this. Let me say a word about, okay. So from here, from this expression, we can see where the gap closes. And you can see that the gap closes at the whole line gamma equals 0 and H being plus or minus 1. So if this is H and this is gamma, this is a critical line. So every time I cross this line, I have a phase transition. Then I have H equal plus 1 and H equal minus 1. And actually, if I put a minus here, there is a minus overall there. Okay. So this point here, when gamma is equal 1, this point here is the quantum critical point of Ising, right? Because at gamma equal 1, we have the Ising model. So this is an extension of the Ising model. But it's nicer because now we have two parameters. Because writing the metric tensor when you have only one parameter, you can do that. It's very boring. At least we get the matrix, right? Okay, so this is the central expression when we have the overlap between two nearby states. And so using this expression to derive gamma and beta, I guess you don't see anymore here, right? Do you see? So the expression for G mu nu is equal to this sum of delta t lambda mu delta theta k delta lambda. Okay, so this is what you find when you insert this overlap in the expression for our metric tensor, and the theta are the thetas defined here. Okay, so now this is a very cumbersome sum to evaluate, but in the thermodynamic limit, we can substitute this sum with L, because L is comes from having sum over many m's. Okay, so this happens in the thermodynamic limit. And then you can compute it analytically. So if you actually do that, if you perform this integration, you get the following matrix, G min nu. So it's diagonal. And we have 1 minus h squared. Here we have a prefactor that is. And this expression is valid for h smaller than 1. And the one for h larger than 1 is a bit cumbersome, and I will not write it. So we can already see something. We see that there is a prefactor L. So this means that my infinitesimal distances, no matter what, they will scale with the total size of the system. So this is the effect of the orthogonality catastrophe. Then no matter whether we are at criticality or not, these statistical distances are increasing just because the size of the system is increasing. But, you know, then I can, it's all here. Now I can disregard it. Now I can see that, for instance, when gamma is going to zero, I have another divergence that is due just to the parameters. So this is marking the quantum phase transition. This is very well seen, for instance, if we compute the Ricci scalar. Okay, so you're doing general relativity, so just compute the Riemann tensor and then the Riemann curvature and the Ricci scalar of this. And what you get, now I can write it for both h smaller than 1 and h greater than 1, is okay. Finally, so we see several things. So now we can compute a density of this R by simply multiplying by L, so that everything that comes from the orthogonality catastrophe is not there anymore. And now we can see all the divergences. So for instance, we can see that this thing diverges at gamma equals 0 when h is smaller than 1. And if you take the limit of h going to plus 1 from the right and the limit of going of h to plus 1 from the left, you will see that this limit, so h going to 1 plus, is equal to minus this. So that you see that at h equal 1, and similarly, so there, on that line, there is a discontinuity of the curvature. So we can draw the phase diagram of the XY model by looking at the Ricci scalar. So this is the final result, is that everything in quantum phase transitions. So now we just did the phase diagram, but we can also see what is the scaling behavior of these objects. And we obtain the same scaling properties that would have order parameters and correlation length and everything. We can redo the whole theory of the scaling behavior, which in these lectures we just barely touched, in the terms of the scaling behavior of these objects. But this has a very powerful interpretation in terms of the information theoretic content of what it is to be the ground state wave function in a quantum many body system, because this metric tensor, as we saw in the first part of the lecture, is just the statistical distance between two quantum distributional probabilities. Yep. Yes, yes, there are black holes. So, yeah, the critical points. So this continuous can give you the critical point and base conditions and what. All the critical behavior. So now we saw just how to see the phase diagram. So we just saw where the critical lines are. But you can also understand the critical behavior, meaning the scaling behavior when you are nearby the critical point by doing the scaling properties of these objects. So if you just do the finite size scaling in the approximation of H being near one, for instance, you will find some critical exponents. So you can find the critical exponents here as well. Sorry? So you're asking whether there is some observable quantity that corresponds to the Ricci tensor here. So I do not believe so. So in this case, this is the Ricci tensor associated to the curvature given by the metric that is this statistical distance. However, in some cases, it does. For instance, so here I took the real part of this metric tensor, but the imaginary part has the meaning of the Berry phase. And in fact, when you have a Berry phase at the critical point, so you know that the Berry phase depends on the area inside the loop that you are taking. So imagine now that you have some critical point, or better, some critical line, and now you, you know, go around this critical line, and you find some Berry phase, okay? And then imagine that you keep shrinking this loop. So typically, as you shrink the loop, in the limit of becoming a point, the Berry phase goes to zero. But if there is a critical point, as you shrink the loop, there is a constant part that doesn't go away that gives you the criticality. And so, in fact, you can see a paper called Berry Phases and Quantum Phase Transitions by myself, where I found basically this thing. The Riemannian tensor is more general, because not every system has a Berry phase. So if you have a real Hamiltonian, you don't get a Berry phase. So you cannot always see these things with the berry face part, although that one has a physical counterpart. I believe that in topological insulators, some of these objects have the meaning of the whole conductance. But this is actually something that I never actually carried over the calculation to see if it is true. But the whole conductance is something that you obtain by integrating over a manifold with some tensor. And I it is to be seen what is there, but there must be some relationship with this metric tensor. Nobody, I mean, I don't know right now. And also a gamma equals 0.
Oh, yeah.
That line. Sorry. Yeah, what did I write? I'm very sorry. Gamma equal to 0, of course, is this line. Sorry about that. So these are the critical lines. So gamma equal to 1 is the Ising model. I mean, this is a family of models, right?
Yeah.
Parameterized by gamma and h. For every value of gamma and h, you get a different model. Then, no, it's just a fact. If you put gamma equal to 0, you'll see that, for instance, now we can use the Ricci curvature, that the Ricci curvature blows up. So gamma is the gamma defined here in the Hamiltonian. You can see that when gamma is equal to 0, both the gap goes to 0 and these differential theoretic quantities, differential geometric quantities blow up. No, here there is no berry face. If you want to see the treatment of the berry faces, you have to take the imaginary part of the psi, the psi. That term will contain the berry face. So I can refer you to my paper to see the berry face. Yes, so this is an approximation that you can do in the large L.
Oh, that's where we use the term.
Yeah. I use the term just to write the sum as an integral. But then I keep it finite. So I know mathematically it's very dirty, but come on. Okay.